So thank you very much, everyone, for and welcome to the Juniper Consortium's monthly seminar. So first of all, I'd like to thank the Isaac Newton Institute for hosting our seminar today and for supporting all of Juniper's dissemination activities. So thank you very much to them and the team there. One piece of housekeeping before I forget. If we're going to do questions today via the Q&A button, which you should find at the bottom of your panel on your Zoom panel at the bottom, there's just a Q&A button. So if you press that and enter your question, and we'll come to questions at the end. So it's my great pleasure today to welcome Dr. Emma Davis, who's a postdoctoral researcher in infectious disease epidemiology at the Big Data Institute at the University of Oxford. She works in Professor Deirdre Hollingsworth group and is also part of the Neglected Tropical Diseases Modelling Consortium. So I think Emma's previous work has really focused more on the area of neglected tropical diseases, but since last year she's turned her attention to looking at COVID-19 and in particular looking at contact tracing. And so it's my great pleasure to welcome her today to talk to us about why contact tracing isn't the perfect tool and the challenges that there are. So thank you very much, Emma, and with that I will pass over to you.
Great, thanks Kira. So I'm going to be talking today about why contact tracing is so hard to get right, and the kind of insights that we've got from modelling contact tracing. This work is hopefully soon going to be published in Nature Communications, and I'll also reference a couple of pieces of work that we have previously published as well. So contact tracing in theory, most people by now through various aspects of the news and potentially work are comfortable with what contact tracing means, but just the basic theory of it is that you find find an infectious case, and then you look at that case's contact history, and then you can alter the behavior of those contacts to prevent onward transmission. So in COVID-19 contact tracing, that means isolation at home to prevent onward transmission. But for other diseases like STIs, it could mean treatment to prevent onward transmission, or like advisory to not engage in risky behaviors. Contact tracing in practice isn't actually as neat as this. We identify a case, and then we try and look at their contact history, and either they don't know everyone that they've been in contact with, or we can't get in touch with everyone that they've identified. So in reality, we only manage to get in touch with some proportion of their contacts. And then these contacts are successfully isolated, and contacts that don't reach continue to potentially transmit. And just the kind of colors here are representing that some of these contacts might be infectious and some of these contacts will be asked to isolate but won't be infectious. So there is a burden on the population of individuals being asked to isolate when they're not infectious as a precaution to prevent onward transmission. So the ideal pathogen for contact tracing, I just thought this was a nice little like kind of thought experiment. And I think the ideal pathogen would be have a short, well-defined infectious period. So you know exactly when someone is transmissible and you can identify exactly who they've contacted during that time. Obvious and specific symptoms. So I've got a person here with the green spots all over their face, but basically symptoms that you can easily identify and aren't related to any other disease. So you can say, yes, this is definitely this disease. No pre-symptomatic transmission, so no transmission or infectiousness before symptoms appear, and also no asymptomatic cases, so no individuals who are lacking in symptoms but still able to transmit infection. With COVID-19, unfortunately, we do not match any of these ideal scenarios. So we have an infectious period of between 5 and 11 days post symptoms, and there is also some infection that can occur pre symptoms as well. So this infectious period is potentially quite long. The symptoms are reasonably noticeable when you get them, but they're quite common symptoms that are shared with other infections, for example, fever being shared with flu or cough being shared with a number of infections. Also, 44%, it's estimated, according to one study, that 44% of transmission might occur pre-symptoms, which is quite a high proportion, and makes it hard to identify and isolate people in time to prevent onward transmission. And also around 30% of cases are believed to be asymptomatic. So a kind of global view of contact tracing, what has worked well. So a number of countries have implemented different methods, and these methods have had varied success in different places. But a few places that I've picked out where they've had particular success are, for example, in Sri Lanka, they have supervised isolation. So if you're contacted and told to isolate, then you are actually supervised and it is ensured that you do not leave isolation because you are monitored the entire time that you are isolating. In South Korea, they have data surveillance laws that were brought in following previous outbreaks of SARS and MERS in those parts of the world. So the government has the legal right to access things like mobile movement data, which means they can tell if people break isolation and they can also more easily identify contacts. In Japan, they do backwards tracing. So rather than starting with a case and then looking at who they might have transmitted to, they start with a case and then look longer in the past at their history of contacts, and they look at who they might have transmitted to, but also who might have transmitted to them. And this is beneficial because it helps find clusters of infection, but also potential super spreaders. In Vietnam, they do secondary and even occasionally tertiary contact tracing. So rather than tracing one generation of contacts, if you have an infectious case, they would trace their contacts and then they would trace the contacts of those contacts in an effort to try and get ahead of the wave of transmission. And in Singapore, they've been using serological tracing once again to do like case investigation to try and find out where cases have come from and to see if they're missing any links in the chains of transmission. So the UK approach. We do manual contact tracing and app-based contact tracing, although their app-based contact tracing is decentralized, which means that although you might get a notification if you've been near someone who then tests positive, no one higher up the chain is able to identify who has been contacted and no one's able to follow up on those people who've been asked to self-isolate. And it also means that you don't necessarily know who or when you might have been pinged by the app. So the way it works is we identify a new case. So either a contact of an existing case that then develops symptoms and tests positive, or a self-reported symptomatic individual who tests positive. And then that person is asked to isolate for 10 days from contact. And their household occupants don't have to isolate. If this individual then develops symptoms, then you then test that individual and the rest of the household then has to isolate. Although it's worth noting that this means that asymptomatic individuals are never tested because you wait until symptoms occur before testing. And then once this test comes back, if it comes back positive, you then trace that individual's contacts and that individual isolates for a further 10 days. And contacts are defined as close contacts. And I believe at the moment we're doing up to 2 days pre-onset of symptoms. If an individual tests negative, the household can stop isolating, but the traced person still finishes their 10-day isolation with the 10 days starting from the contact or the identification of that case. And then this process restarts from the beginning with any traced contacts. have been a few changes across the pandemic, which has made modelling quite difficult because often these changes are quite short notice. And we've been working on modelling a particular scenario, and then all of a sudden the parameters have changed. So some of the key changes across the pandemic have been the rollout of NHS Test and Trace to begin with. Like, the first time it started was on the 28th of May. It started in England. And then it wasn't until late September when the NHS COVID-19 app was launched. Shortly after that, it was announced that isolation was going to be legally mandated. So if you're contacted by Test and Trace or through the app and told to self-isolate and you break that isolation, you could potentially be fined a large amount of money. And then in October, so quite a long time after Test and Trace began, a support scheme for low-income individuals was launched to try and improve adherence to isolation, although this was only available for manually traced individuals. Because of the decentralized system on the app, it meant that it wasn't possible at that point to identify individuals that were contacted through the app, so they couldn't be involved in this scheme. But by December, they managed to extend the support scheme to contacts identified through the app. On the 11th of December, they also decreased the isolation period from 14 days to 10 days. So what I just described on the previous slide, that's the current system, but up until the 11th of December, it was 14 days of isolation rather than 10. And what I haven't got on here, which has been announced this week, is the new update that's going to come into play mid-August, which is that individuals who've been fully vaccinated won't be asked to self-isolate, or if they're asked to self-isolate, they won't have to do it. So, potential pitfalls for this contact tracing system. To begin with, and as we'll see later from our results, this is a particularly important point. Isolation adherence is poor, with some estimates from surveys being as low as 11% of people fully adhering to isolation. Self-reporting rates are also poor, with some estimates as low as 12%, and also not all individuals provide full details of all the contacts that they've had within the relevant period. This may be for due to forgetfulness or reporting error, but it also might be because individuals, now that isolation is mandated and as a potential fine, individuals might not want to pass on that burden to their contacts if they know that it would perhaps be difficult for some of their contacts to isolate. Testing and tracing are also quite slow. It often takes up to or beyond 72 hours from a case being identified to the next case being contacted, asked to isolate, and potentially tested. And also, we've seen from STIs and other diseases like Ebola that asymptomatic tracing is potentially a key benefit of contact tracing. And it's not something that we are currently doing in our system. So I'm just going to talk about methods for a bit. So the secondary case distribution is the number of secondary cases or the number of new cases caused by one infectious individual. It's the distribution of that metric, which is, and the mean of this distribution is the R number. And here I've just done a bit of an example to kind of show how this distribution can change. So here we've assumed a mean or an R number of 2.6 in all cases. And then we've looked at the different, varying aggregation to see what this means for the secondary case distribution. So aggregation is a parameter that defines how clustered transmission is. So the plot on the left has aggregation parameter k equals 5, which represents quite low aggregation. And in this scenario, you can see from this plot, so along the x-axis is the number of secondary cases, and along the y-axis is the proportion or the probability. So the maximum number of new cases In this particular sample is 16. So the most number of new cases that you might infect is 16, and the 12% of all individuals will infect known new cases. And then if you look to the middle, K equals one, so we have medium aggregation. Here we have 28% of individuals generate no new cases, but a few individuals can generate up to 38 or so new cases. So you have greater disparity between the transmission from individuals. And then on the far right, we have high aggregation of K equals 0.1. And here, 72% of people who are infected by the disease don't transmit to anyone, whereas some individuals can be huge super spreaders, transmitting to as many as 100, 200 people. I haven't put it on here, but in reality, I'll mention later, the value that we went with for the model is about K equals 0.2, 0.23. So we're closer to this scenario on the right, where you have some super spreaders and a lot of people transmit to no one at all. Okay, so the incubation period we took as a log normal distribution from Lee et al. And we took it to have a mean of 1.5 days. The infectivity profile we took from He et al. And we fitted our own model to that data. And here you can see that we're allowing for pre-symptomatic transmission because along the symptom onset in days, and this is time from symptom onset in days to infection or infectiousness as a function of symptom onset. So the pre-symptomatic transmission is anything that occurs before this time is zero, so before symptom onset occurs, and symptomatic transmission is from zero onwards. So the serial interval is the time between the beginning of symptoms from a primary case or an infector, case person A on the left, to the time of symptoms of the secondary case or the infectee, person B on the right. And you can see from this plot on the left that you can have a negative serial interval. And this can be negative if person A has a longer incubation period and pre-symptomatic and transmits pre-symptomatically to person B, and also person B has a shorter incubation period. So it's possible that person B's incubation period could finish and some onset could occur in person B before person A has had symptoms. The generation interval, however, is the time between infection events. So rather than the time between symptoms, it's the time between infections. So the primary case A infects the secondary case B on the right. And I apologies for the bullet points left at the bottom. I didn't delete them from the previous slide. The generation interval cannot be negative. If you see on the right, it starts at zero and then peaks about 3.5 days. So additional assumptions. We assumed that 31% of cases were asymptomatic. We also assumed that it would take between 0 and 2 days to test individuals, representing the difference between rapid tests and slower PCR tests, where the target is to hear back in usually 48 hours. And then we also considered different test sensitivities of 65% and 95%, which were chosen to approximately represent the sensitivity of LFD tests and the sensitivity of PCR tests, respectively. Also, as I mentioned before, the negative binomial offspring of secondary case distribution, we assumed an aggregation of 0.23. So quite a lot of super spreaders and quite a lot of clustering and quite a lot of individuals who don't transmit to anyone. Our model structure, we built on a branching process transmission model published in early 2020, Helliwell et al. And this is a model where you start with one or some number of infectious cases, and then at each step of the model, each time step, you use the secondary case distribution, so the negative binomial, to sample how many new cases that individual person will have created. And then from that point, you then do the same again and the same again, and you get a tree of transmission. And then we can impose the contact tracing over the top of this and say, well, if we'd traced this individual, then if, say, we're managing to trace 60% of their contacts, then you can sample which contacts you would have traced and sample the time of tracing as well, and say, well, these contacts would have been isolating from this time until this time, and then you can look at their onward transmissions and see if you would have prevented any of those onward transmissions. So this is a rather detailed example of how things can work in our model under our assumptions. So I'll just talk through it. I'll try and go slowly so that I don't rush through. So person A is the initial infected case, and they are exposed at a particular time period, and then they have a pre-infectious period before they become infectious, the dashed line at the start of the orange section. And then the orange section is the pre-symptomatic period, where they are infectious, but they do not have symptoms. And during this time, they might transmit to individuals, such as individual B. After symptom onset, they're still infectious and they could transmit again, potentially to person C. So there's multiple, so there's possibility for transmission across this whole period. But then at a particular time after symptoms, maybe the symptoms start to worsen, or they realize that actually these symptoms are COVID-19 symptoms, this person might isolate and report their symptoms to test and trace, at which point a test would be ordered, and after a period of time that would come back. And if that came back positive, then their cases would then be traced. And if that came back negative, then that person would continue to isolate, but they would not have any of their contacts traced. So in person A's case, the test comes back positive. And then we move, and then so then tracing is initiated. And in this scenario, we've assumed that person B and person D are both traced and person C is untraced. So here are about two-thirds of cases, two-thirds of contacts are being managed to be traced. There is then some period of time. So if you look at person B and the dashed line going down from test, there's some period of time it takes to trace this individual, and at that point they're asked to isolate, and then there's some period of time to then test this individual. And even if they are a case, there's a chance that this might come back false negative. And in some policies, not our policy at the moment, but in some scenarios, countries may release an individual from isolation at the point of negative test. Which if that test came back false negative, means that they could then transmit onwards in the future and create new infections before the end of their infectious period. Person C is untraced and asymptomatic, so they never have a chance to identify their symptoms or report themselves to the tracing system, which means that they are just left in the population non-isolated and able to transmit for the whole of their infectious period. And person D is traced, but is traced before their symptom onset, and hence some of that pre-symptomatic period is captured as well. So moving on to results. The first, thinking about outbreak risk. So here along the y-axis, we have the probability of a large outbreak given a different scenario where we've defined a large outbreak as being more than 2,000 cases in a particular region or area. And along the x-axis, we have contact tracing coverage, where coverage is defined as the proportion of the proportion of contacts that are successfully traced and asked to isolate. So we've ranged this between 0 to 0.8 or 80%. On the left-hand side, we've considered an R value under social distancing of 1.3. And on the right-hand side, we've considered an R value under social distancing of 1.5. So these have been picked to be somewhat above R of equal to 1, but also below what we believe the R naught value to be. So this is representing some level of social distancing in the population. And you can see in the top row, which is the poor or low adherence and reporting, where we've assumed this 11% figure mentioned earlier at the start, you can see that as you scale up contact tracing coverage, there's no observable benefit because there's no observable decrease in the probability of a large outbreak. And this is likely because you're managing to trace and identify individuals, but when you're asking them to isolate, they aren't adhering to it, and hence transmission is basically continuing unhindered in the majority of cases. However, in the second row on the bottom half, here we've considered good adherence and reporting. So around 50% self-reporting, which is 50% of individuals with symptoms contacting test and trace and letting them know that they have symptoms, and 65% of people fully adhering to isolation. Then you can see a visible benefit of TTI as you scale up the proportion of contacts that are traced. And you can also see from the green dashed line being below the orange line, that if you have faster tracing, so instant tracing as opposed to a two-day delay, then you do have a marginally lower risk of outbreak. Looking at the same scenarios, but looking at the impact on R, in the low reporting and adherence, once again, we see no observable benefit of TTI. We only just see stochastic variation around zero and no clear observable benefit of faster tracing. In the good adherence reporting scenario, we see a visible benefit of TTI with the impact of contact tracing increasing from zero with no contact tracing coverage up to a 14% reduction in R in some scenarios if you assume instant tracing and a higher background R number. So if you have a higher background R number before contact tracing, then your percentage reduction will be higher. So considering testing, I've mentioned we were looking at high sensitivity and low sensitivity and slow and fast tests to try and think about the differences between using PCR, which is what's currently used in contact tracing, and using LFDs, which are being rolled out quite widely across the country for other purposes. And if you look at these graphs, you can see if you pick out the green dashed line, that represents the instant tracing with 65% sensitivity. And then the red solid line, which is the two-day delay with 95% sensitivity. And you can see on both sides of the graph that the red solid line is mostly below the dashed green line, which implies that there is no benefit, there would probably be no benefit switching to a faster test if you were compromising on test sensitivity in the assumption that we've taken on the difference in sensitivities, but also that there could potentially be a detriment to switching to a faster test if that test was of poor sensitivity. So here we looked at the total number of cases so far in an outbreak. So starting with zero cases so far, well, one case so far, all the way up to 1,000 cases so far, which represents the total cases rather than the observed cases in an outbreak. And then we've looked again at this probability of getting an outbreak of 2,000 or more cases. And you can see on the left-hand column, which is the poor reporting and adherence column, as the total number of cases so far increases, the probability of a large outbreak very rapidly climbs to one. And increasing contact tracing coverage, so looking at the colour of the lines, increasing from a blue solid line to a green dotted line in the contact tracing coverage, representing a scale up to 80% contact tracing, you see no observable difference really between the lines on the left-hand column with the poor reporting, which reflects what we concluded earlier, looking at the overall benefit of test and trace. However, there's two other scenarios that we've considered: the good reporting and adherence, which was the 50% reporting and the 65% adherence. But we also considered a scenario with boosted adherence, so keeping reporting the same, but creating some kind of additional incentive or support to boost adherence up to closer to 90%. So here, I didn't mention previously, but the 65% and the 50% used in the good reporting and adherence scenario in the center represents a survey's findings on the intention to adhere to isolation, which we took as a kind of upper bound of the current scenario. So you can see here that the scale up with cases of the probability of a large outbreak is much slower. You can see a very, very clear benefit of increasing contact tracing coverage. And also the plots on the top row with instant tracing, you can see that having quicker tracing, assuming the same test sensitivity, does create like an exaggerated benefit to having high contact tracing coverage, because you get a higher, like a larger gap between these lines. In a separate study, we looked at adherence trade-offs. So we were looking at this before the UK government mandated that that isolation was legally required if you were contacted. And we were looking at the potential trade-offs that this could cause, because there's a number of things that could affect adherence, such as like willful non-adherence, but also there's a lot of logistic and financial reasons that could cause people to not be able to adhere to requested self-isolation. So we were concerned that if isolation was legally mandated, this would increase adherence because people would be more worried about falling foul of the law, but that this could reduce other factors, such as the probability that individuals with symptoms would self-report to test and trace. Because if you don't report to test and trace, then you're not asked to self-isolate, and then you're not legally required to follow the guidance that you're given. And the same with reporting your contacts. If you have contacts that you think would find it very difficult to isolate, then you might, even if you were identified as a contact, so you couldn't get out of it and you tested positive, you might not refer your contacts to the system because you might not want them to have the burden of being legally required to isolate. So we kind of looked at the trade-offs between increasing adherence to isolation, but potentially decreasing this self-reporting probability and also the contact reporting probability. So here in the plot on the right-hand side, we considered a fixed control effectiveness or contact tracing coverage, so number of contacts, proportion of contacts traced of 60%. And a background R under social distancing of 1.3. And then we considered the risk of a large outbreak for different self-reporting probabilities. And we considered two different ways of measuring adherence. We considered the minimum number of days that an individual might isolate, which is the top plot. So we considered between 1 and 14 days to kind of look at the duration and the kind of leakiness of isolation over time, but also looking at the overall adherence to self-isolation. So between 10% and 70% on the bottom row. And you can see that the self-reporting probability makes a quite a big difference to the risk of a large outbreak, which is represented here in percentage rather than probability. And the drop is actually quite steep as you scale the self-report probability up. But if self-isolation is low, then obviously there's less. And if self-isolation is high, then there's more. So really you want to try and maximize isolation adherence and reporting probability rather than trade them off against each other, which implies that you might need other measures on top of mandating isolation to encourage people to engage with the system. So you can see that that self-isolation does make a difference, but the minimum isolation period makes a much smaller difference. And this is mainly because people are most infectious at the start of the period where you ask them to isolate. So even if they only manage that isolation for a shorter period of time, like 4 days, then that's still going to be similar in terms of benefit to them managing the full length of time. And at the time of this modeling, it was 14 days was the advisory. And the reduction to 10 days kind of reflects this decrease in infectiousness later in your infectious period. So key conclusions that we found that adherence is the singular most important factor of success. So if you have poor adherence, then contact tracing basically has very limited capacity to achieve much at all. But that fast tracing is beneficial, as it would have been assumed, but potentially as a secondary consideration. And also that higher coverage means higher impact, particularly if you're maximized on the other in the other scenarios. We modeled up reductions in R of up to 15% in some scenarios, although if you assumed a higher background R number under social distancing, then you might expect a higher percentage reduction in R, but obviously the absolute value of R would still be higher. And also we generally concluded that test, trace, and isolate is not appropriate as the sole control measure at the moment. Although with the scale up of vaccination, artificially bringing the R number down, then potentially it could be in the future. Other work that our group has done or is doing, I'll just give you a brief overview. So we had a paper published by Tom Crellin in the Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society B, looking at a deterministic model of waning immunity. So this was work that was done in early to mid 2020. So we were considering the waning immunity of acquired immunity through infection, but these results have since been rediscussed and reassessed thinking about vaccination. And also ongoing work, we're building on existing branching process modeling, including thinking about the impacts of vaccination. But also we have a number of wonderful PhD students and research assistants looking at things like network model development for care home settings, analysis around socioeconomic deprivation and vaccine uptake and how that might be influencing what we're seeing now in terms of the increases in cases and the slow but existing increases in hospitalizations and deaths, and also an evaluation of these negative binomial assumptions. Because the negative binomial is widely and commonly used, and it is able to reflect these super spreading phenomenons that we see, but it is a fairly rigid framework to operate within. I'd just like to finish by acknowledging in particular Tim Lucas, who did all of this work with me, and also the supervision of Deirdre Hollingsworth and Petra Klepak, and also the rest of the Oxford team, Anna, Tim, Tom, Dupriet and Lee, and since we've had a number of new people join as well, and also very much thank you to RAMP for leveraging our experience with elimination dynamics for NTDs to kind of focus on COVID, and also the CMMID COVID-19 working group. We've worked quite closely with the authors of the original paper that we were building on, the Helliwell et al. Paper. Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you very much, Emma. That was really interesting. So while people think of questions, as I said at the beginning and in the chat, please use the Q&A button. So if you just press the Q&A button at the bottom to ask Emma a question, that would be great. So Julia actually has a question, and since she's a panelist, she can't put it in the Q&A button. But so Julia asks, you've explored lots of ways to improve UK's TTI and also mentioned some further options used by other countries, backwards tracing, secondary, tertiary tracing. So bringing this together with what would be possible, acceptable, achievable by the UK, if you could go back in time and reshape our TTI scheme from last summer, what would be the most important thing to change? That's quite a tricky one, Julia. But yes, if you could jump in your time machine, what would you do?
I think I would introduce contact tracing sooner than August, so much earlier in the pandemic. But I think mostly, like, the key issue being adherence, I'd really like focus on making sure that there were systems in place to support individuals both financially and logistically who are asked to self-isolate, and really like pushing the education message about how important it is to do like what you're advised to do in terms of the adherence to all of these measures.
On the adherence, I just wanted to follow up with a question regarding adherence. So do you know if anyone, or if you guys are thinking about looking at, you know, how much people need to be paid to sort of support them in self-isolation, and I guess sort of looking at the more economic aspects that would incentivize someone to actually adhere to the rules? So
I think that would be really interesting. And I think definitely a factor in the poor adherence is likely to be the kind of difficulty or the kind of red tape around access to the financial support that does exist. And also the fact that I believe the financial support that exists is only available for individuals who are on some kind of universal credit or benefits or some other, who are already recognized in some other system. For example, most, I think, higher paid individuals, there's some kind of assumption that their companies would allow them paid leave during isolation. But yeah, it's kind of unclear how this is supposed to, how they're supposed to be benefit for the wider population in general.
Right, so we've had a couple of questions come in. So Louise Dyson asks, is the test sensitivity modelled as being constant, or does it change over the period of infection? And she's asking because LFTs tend to be more sensitive at higher viral loads.
Yeah, so we haven't modelled it over time. That's something we've since included in the model, and it's something we've since doing this work we've started thinking about, but I have looked at the time in which, like, the time at which individuals in the model are tested, and then compared that to temporal curves of test sensitivity, and generally people are being tested during the window of a few days on either side of kind of peak test sensitivity for both PCRs and LFTs. But I think assuming more than a 65% sensitivity of an LFT would at least be perceived, I think, as unduly optimistic, particularly if you're assuming self-swabbing.
Thank you. So Ellen Brooks Pollock asks, how does the effectiveness of contact tracing compare to general COVID security measures? And what should be in place for the long term?
The effectiveness of contact tracing. So I think...
So she says, and what do you think about contact tracing in schools?
In schools. We haven't really thought about schools. But I think contact tracing has the potential to have a lot higher relative impact than it's having at the moment. But I think it's still, it would require perhaps like unrealistic levels of, or maybe socially unacceptable levels of surveillance and mandation for it to really be able to compare to things like lockdowns and like widespread social distancing measures. I don't see why there's any reason why if we increase the effectiveness of our current system within the parameters that we can influence, there's no reason why that could be a viable option when combined with the vaccine rollout in the future. In terms of schools, I think just contact networks in schools are very difficult to define and to kind of use, I guess, as we've seen in like the bubbling systems and how it's resulted in like many children missing large portions of school, often multiple times in a term. We haven't thought specifically about schools, but we have done some thinking about like households and that kind of perspective. But yeah, schools is a really interesting point.
Thank you. And I guess under that, universities possibly as well.
Yeah.
Higher education settings. Great. Well, so I think we've if anyone's got any more questions, this is your time to ask. And if not, then I'd like to thank Emma very much for a really interesting thought. So Noan, thank you very much. And yeah, Julia says fab talk and good answers. So thank you very much for a fantastic talk, Emma. It was really interesting. And if any of your colleagues couldn't make it, this talk has been recorded and will be posted on the INI website afterwards. So thank you very much. And I hope you all have a lovely day. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you very much for having me, Kira.
Bye. Bye, everyone.